Hello there, pod person. Welcome to a podcast-only edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And for you this week, Wagner lovers and Wagner haters, a little bit of rock and roll piano resurrection, and some timely adulting from comedian Maurice Gohan. But first, do you like Wagner at all? Should you? Wagnerism is the title of an aptly girthy new study of the composer by New Yorker classical music critic Alex Ross. The book is Ross's attempt not so much to stare directly into the heart of Wagner, but to catch his reflection, or indeed his shadow, both in his contemporaries and everyone after, from civil rights pioneers to, well, Nazis.
Backshadowing is a very useful concept that the critic Michael Andre Bernstein used to talk about this problem that develops when we read history in light of what was to come, and especially when we see the history of the 19th century and early 20th century as this inevitable, irreversible march toward Hitler. There are many strands of the culture and history of that period which don't fit that model or can be distorted if we only look at it through that lens. This quantity of Wagner and what it means to be Wagnerian keeps evolving and changing as the years go by and as we go from the 19th into the early 20th century. And it's a bit ironic because we think of Wagner as such a domineering and ominously controlling figure who wants the audience to experience everything the same way, you know, according to his principles. But in fact, there's a great deal of chaos right from the start and a great deal of debate over what these works meant. And sort of this kind of multiplication of Wagner's and sort of meanings connected with Wagner. And that's really what the book is about. It's sort of this explosion of responses to this single man and his work in every imaginable direction. It's a kind of singular phenomenon, I think, in cultural history that he had such acute impact all across the arts, and those reverberations continue today. Sure, if I qualify as a full-fledged Wagnerian, you know, certainly I've been fascinated by him for a long time, but I've just always been fascinated by the effect that he has had as much as by the music itself. And I started out really not comprehending his music at all. When I was a kid, I was a very avid listener to classical music, especially the instrumental tradition, kind of Bach to Brahms, a little bit of Mahler and Sibelius there at the end. And when I first tried to listen to Wagner, I was confused. I felt uneasy. I felt slightly sick to my stomach. I was used to this very clear presentation of, you know, here's the first theme, here's the second theme, development, recapitulation. Wagner was all this kind of stream of one thing bleeding into another, and you're never quite sure where you were and where you were going. And so I had this adverse reaction and didn't come back to him for quite a while. It really wasn't until quite a bit later, when I was in my 20s and I was going to the opera regularly as a critic and experiencing Wagner in the theater, that I began to develop an appreciation for the works as masterly psychological experiences, as well as ones that are charged with all of these political questions. And so I've become steadily more appreciative as the years have gone by. But I think, you know, there's this ambivalence always has to remain. You can never sort of quite embrace Wagner wholeheartedly. And I think actually I can never really claim to have gotten to the bottom of it, you know, because every time I come back to it sort of means something different. And so it's this ever evolving relationship. And perhaps I'll eventually go back to loathing Wagner. I don't know. But it's always fluctuating in that way. He is German, all too German, extremely nationalist in his views throughout his life. And of course, he's an absolutely ferocious anti-Semite. And that would seem, you might think, that this would have severely limited the appeal of his music to people outside that group. And yet that wasn't the case at all. People were certainly aware of Wagner's anti-Semitism, but especially in the later 19th century, it wasn't a dominant topic in terms of how Wagner was perceived. And even Wagner's Germanness was held somewhat at arm's length. I mean, if you look at how French Wagnerians, beginning spectacularly with Baudelaire in 1861, embraced Wagner as this great avant-garde bohemian figure who represents this liberation of the consciousness and a doorway to the dream state. Wagner's Germanness really didn't enter into their thinking at all. They sort of ignored it almost completely. And then you have this very interesting phenomenon of minority groups, sort of socially marginalized groups, who embrace Wagner as a kind of vehicle to their own potential social and cultural ascent. You know, sort of they're kind of coming into their own. And what happens is that Wagner's model of reviving myth and giving it contemporary relevance is a model for how African Americans, say, can reach back to ancient myth, ancient legend in their own traditions and bring it to life. Irish nationalists sort of looked at Wagner through something of the same lens. Yeats saw Wagner as a model in that way. The Catalan Wagnerians, and of course I talk about the Jewish Wagnerians, and that's a very sort of difficult phenomenon to really encompass, because I think the Wagner's Jewish fans at the end of the 19th century were coming from several different directions. It was not monolithic at all, but you did have this astonishing fact that Theodor Herzl, at the time he was writing The Jewish State, his prophecy of the Zionist state, was regularly attending Tannhäuser at the opera in Paris and said that only on the evenings when he did not see the opera was he not inspired by his idea. In other words, that somehow witnessing the opera was integral. It impelled the development of his ideas. And that's remarkable, but it's a sign of how Wagner can leap beyond his specific context and become a model to people of all different backgrounds and traditions.
And that's kind of underlined by the influence you trace in your book of Wagner on African Americans, and particularly the civil rights pioneer W.E.B. Du Bois.
Of course, Wagner can mean many different things to many people, even those who would seem to be in a place of inferiority, according to Wagner's racial views. And in fact, on the question of Black people, Wagner didn't have a lot to say. And some of the comments that you see in his diaries are actually quite sympathetic. So I think among African Americans of the later 19th, early 20th centuries, Wagner was not seen as, you know, the enemy. And he could even be seen as an ally of a sort, a model for employing myth as a way of ennobling a particular tradition, whether it's African American or any other, empowering that tradition. Du Bois went to hear Wagner in concert and in the opera house. He was studying in Berlin in the 1890s and had a number of crucial experiences there, and he was just swept away. And there was sort of nothing obvious sort of standing in the way of this enthusiasm. It made perfect sense to him. A lot of African Americans of that generation generally had a veneration for German culture. And they saw it as something outside of the abiding racial horror of the United States. Du Bois always said that he felt free. He felt like a free man in Germany. Even when he went to Germany in 1936, he still felt better treated than he had back home. And this, of course, was the summer of the Nazi Olympics, but he went to the Bayreuth Festival because it was finally his chance to hear Wagner at Bayreuth. And so he wrote a very crucial chapter of his book, The Souls of Black Folk, from 1903, which is one of the founding documents of the modern American civil rights movement. I mean, Du Bois was just a gigantic figure for that movement, much more radical than Booker T. Washington and figures who had come before. But he chooses to have this one fictional story in The Souls of Black Folk called Of the Coming of John. Which is about a young black man who sees a possible brighter future for himself as he goes off to school. And he goes to a concert and hears the prelude to Lohengrin and is swept away by it and is enchanted by it. And then there's a tap on his shoulder and he's being asked to leave because the white couple next to him feel uncomfortable. The story goes on to a tragic end. And so this vision of future freedom and future power that he has while listening to Wagner is ironic, entirely unfulfilled, but it lingers with him. And at the moment, at the end of the book, when he's about to be lynched by a white mob, the Wagner is still echoing in his head.
It sort of underlines what we've been talking about so far, which is the way that different people could find uses for Wagner, because there in that scene at the opera, he's sitting there thinking of a future that he could develop for himself and his people. And beside him is a racist who finds this the most fantastic music and has come to hear it.
Wagner had this effect where the music struck so many people, speaking directly to them in this incredibly unique way. Each person walks away with completely different ideas of what this music means, and in many cases, just completely contradictory ideas.
It's very interesting that this book appears at this exact moment. We are in an era where we're thinking much more carefully about the character and politics of the creator. The way Wagner has been treated in your book and through history is something of a model of that. There is something in the work that can be separated from its worst elements.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that there's something in Wagner that can be separated, some positive quantity that can be separated from the negative. I don't think that's possible. They're always bound together. Everything from the past will have some shadow behind it. And Walter Benjamin made the statement that every work of civilization cannot be separated from barbarism, and so there are dark stories behind all of these works that we treasure. And so the question is, what do we do about them? And yes, I think this long contestation with Wagner is in some ways a model for how we should go about doing this. Because, you know, since the 1850s, people have been contemplating the question, is Wagner too horrible a man to listen to his music? And yet the music has remained, and something about it compels our attention. And so we proceed in so many ways to try to make sense of the past, to learn from the past, which sometimes seems, you know, a hopeless exercise, because in my country, we are frankly teetering on the verge of a full-fledged authoritarian quasi-fascist regime. And yet for decades in the United States, the bookstores have been full of books about Nazi Germany and the war and you know, the struggle against evil. Has anything at all been learned from that engagement? Sometimes it's hard to see. You know, have we learned from Wagner and this story of how art and myth can be manipulated to political ends? And I wonder about that when I see all of these superhero movies and the good American accented heroes going into battle with the forces of evil. You know, has our own popular culture become the tool for, you know, American imperialism? I think absolutely yes, but it's a somewhat underexamined relationship, and the story of Wagner and Wagnerism indicates how important it is to be actively conscious of those relationships. You know, going through the story again gave me a sense, at least, that, you know, we can have deep and valuable and fruitful relationships with our problematic past without idealizing it, without expecting it to play some purely kind of redemptive and uplifting role in our ideas. And I think that's the mistake to begin with, is to sort of treat Wagner ideally as something sort of outside of the everyday human. Of course, we long for that glimpse of some other world through art, but at the other end of that relationship can be some quite ugly developments. And so, you know, that's ultimately what the story of Wagner tells us.
Alex Ross there, author of Wagnerism, and we'll put a longer version of that conversation out as a podcast. And Alex will be joining us to explain why it is that, despite everything, Wagner hasn't been cancelled yet. On Saturday evening in this month's Culture File debate, he'll be one of the panel discussing the long history of cultural cancellation. That's in the Culture File debate, Saturday evening at 6:30 p.m. here on RTE Lyric FM. Next on the Culture File Weekly, a trip into the Wicklow Hills to meet therapist, keyboard player and piano technician Jamie Fox. In the Fox and Wolf workshop, more on Mr. Wolf presently, living dead pianos are welcomed into a new life. Here, they're not just reconditioned, revoiced, regulated and tuned to concert pitch. They're also given a beauty makeover, involving anything from animal prints to Jungian dreamscapes. Culture File's Louise McMahon went to Hollywood, County Wicklow, for a masked chat with Mr. Fox.
Now, so what piano is this one?
This is Icaro. Looks like a jacket I saw one time in Berlin. Fox and Wolf for me and my dog, Wolfie.
Which I was glad to recreate, but unfortunately I never got to buy the jacket.
So it's kind of a family operation. My wife helps me as well. Dog's mostly for moral support.
Cool. Yeah. And then the pinks and the blues and the bright colours.
I started with a friend of mine who looked like a wolf. He was a builder, but unfortunately he didn't have time to commit and he was just too busy doing other jobs.
They are very punky looking.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of going for sometimes.
So I had to get a dog to keep the name called Wolfie. So that's who we are, I suppose. I was in a band called Fight Like Apes, who toured around Europe and America and stuff. And that went well, but that was kind of my 20s. I basically just became a piano tuner as a way of segueing out of the band. I played synthesizers. That's kind of the theme, I suppose, in general. I like balancing something that is old and accepted with something that is new and trying to find the juxtaposition and how can I live in the juxtaposition of that. I'm working on an electronic album at the moment, so it's like a tallow disco. It's a nice balance from playing pianos all day.
You are kind.
I got very, very bored of going to people's homes and playing the same piano every day. It was all black lacquer or dated mahogany with a very, very kind of shiny polish on it, and I just wasn't excited by going to work anymore. It felt like I was going to the same living room every day. So I decided that I'd make one for myself and see what it went like. Then people seemed to be interested in it, so I continued to do it.
You are mine.
It kind of started out quite basic with just, you know, one colour or two tones. But I started noticing that people were actually more interested in the further I pushed it.
Isolation.
I suppose I come from a world of being in a band. It was kind of a particular style of punk rock. When I started doing the pianos, I nearly wanted to bring that aesthetic to a piano. The idea was that I would play the piano and try and feel what it looked like.
You. I do. I wanna isolate with you.
So I generally sit down and play the piano for a few hours and kind of get a rough idea of what I would like to do to it. At this point, when I start a piano, it looks a certain way, and then I scrap everything, but I use that as a new base to create something new. it's just kind of a process where I have no idea what I'm creating until the end result, you know, comes out of it. And I know when I'm finished, I'm like, okay, that's finished. But there's times where I'm like, I'll have a piano lying around for 3 months and I'll be working on it and it just doesn't feel right. Most of it seems to be gut, lack of planning, constantly trying to bring order to the chaos I've created. And then, you know, if I bring too much order to it, to introduce more chaos and trying to find that balance. I sometimes use like metal paint, I use polyurethane, things like that. I tend to just paint the piano one colour and then start working from there and start scratching it off and seeing where that goes. I use whatever textures I can. I use a lot of blowtorching. I use epoxy. Sometimes it tends to work out in a way of, this is your first time trying a certain thing, like decoupage or anything like that, and you kind of get a bit of beginner's luck. Mixed medium would be the best way of describing it.
You, just you.
Most of the names come from Jungian philosophy. I'm also interested in things like Buddhism and Sanskrit. I kind of like the idea of merging the old with the new, and I kind of get a feeling of the metaphor of what that piano was and name it accordingly. We've got alchemy, Ouroboros, Yage, Anima, a lot of A nuns, Albedo, Bardo, names like that. I generally get them at auction. I go to England or Germany, buy a few and come back. The moment that hasn't really been possible, so I'm kind of just buying what I can, I suppose, what I like. But generally I love working on German pianos. I also like British pianos as well. A lot of the time I do get messages from people saying, will you come take away my piano? And there's an old saying that there's no such thing as a free piano, and that's very true. It could be a few extra months of my life trying to get that piano back into shape. So I try to buy pianos that already have something beautiful about them that need to be restored. So I'm big into Bechsteins and pianos like that. I'm working on a Challen Baby Grand at the moment. I've got a lovely kind of a Bentley bungalow piano that I call Icaro. Thing about making pianos that are very colourful, but it's nice when somebody appreciates the sound, because I tried to get a fairly specific sound. So the first process is always for me to give it a good tune, bring it up to concert pitch and to voice it and see what it sounds like, and then try and get a feel for that. And it's only then really that I won't do any proper regulation or anything. At that point, then I'll start working on what it's going to look like. And then at the very end, I generally give it another tune and start to regulate the piano.
And the other piano's actually, it's just been moved and it's hideous. Yeah, tune.
The design on it is beautiful, though.
Yeah, I know, and it's a gorgeous tone, but it's really, really bad the energy.
Oh, wow, the tone is stunning, it's isn't it?
Very influenced by, there's a piano company called Clavin's Piano Company that make unicordis. That's the kind of sound I'm going for, something that's not bright, that's warm, that's, you know, low in timbre and kind of lush, as opposed to a lot of modern uprights, which are very, very bright and tinny, I suppose. So I think we've a motto, which is the only thing bright about a piano should be its colour scheme.
Jamie Fox of Fox and Wolf there at his workshop in Hollywood. The reporter was Louise McMahon. And finally, what better way to finish the week than with a visit to the doctor? Many, to be honest, but as our regular columnist, writer and comedian Maurice Gohan is here to testify, sometimes the demands of fully-fledged adulthood risk getting in the way of the lols.
I am so young. I'm barely out of nappies. I'm ID'd buying the mature Calpol. If you saw me driving, you'd think, how did a baby get a license? Sometimes other people don't see me as I see myself, though. There used to be a 16-year-old girl who worked the door of a comedy club in Dublin. We were friends. I bought her 2 cans of cider once. Mates. And one night she was like, I hope when I get to your age I have things figured out. And I was like, excuse me? We're the same age. Two young gals doing our leaving cert. But no, she saw me as an elder. When we crossed the road and she linked arms with me, it wasn't in a girl pal way. She was afraid I'd fall down. I get it though. Youth is relative. I remember watching Girl Interrupted when I was 16, and Winona Ryder says, "I really thought I was going to be somebody by the time I was 23. And I thought, 23? That is ancient. If I'm not married by 23 and CEO of some company, I will have failed. I'm now 29 and I can't even tell you what CEO stands for. Central Equipped Officer. I'm old to some people, but still young to other people. It's all relative. 29 is a weird age though, because I feel like I'm straddling two worlds. I have friends still vomiting on the streets when they get drunk, and I have other friends who are doctors. Some friends are both. It's confusing. When a friend gets pregnant now, I'm not sure whether to say congratulations or, oh no, what are you going to do? I'm in life purgatory. I have friends buying houses with their partners now, showing me the deeds like you would an engagement ring. A joint mortgage? I'm sorry, but that's not a boyfriend, that's a business partner. I thought we all collectively agreed in 2008 that we weren't doing that anymore. We were going to be the generation that stopped buying houses, stopped getting mortgages, would become European and just rent our whole lives. I thought we all decided savings were D-Class A. And turns out everybody was secretly stashing away thousands of euro and secretly having rich parents give them deposits. I feel duped. I'm a one-woman economic stimulus package. Every cent I get, I put right back in the economy. I thought my peers were on the same train as me. We were in a collective movement. Until I woke up at 29 with €3 in my bank account, and now I'm being called financially irresponsible. Time to grow up, my mother tells me all the time. Welcome to adulthood. What even is adulthood? I do get excited buying a frying pan now. Is that being an adult? Is buying a house being an adult? We're taking out insurance? A few years ago, I went out with a man 25 years my senior. Surely that's super adult of me. I got my smear test earlier this year. That's quite adult. I got the results last month, came back abnormal. That's definitely adult. I really didn't want to get the biopsy done because I knew it would hurt. They're taking out a tiny chunk of your body. And sometimes it's easier to ignore the things that scare you. But I called up the clinic, also very adult, to make a phone call and had my appointment. It didn't hurt at all. And I have a very low threshold for pain. If I stub a toe, I'm out of action for a week. The biopsy felt like a pinch, which is a thing medical people tell you when something is about to hurt really bad. But in this case, it really was a pinch. And now I have a slice of my cervix gone. I actually feel a lot lighter. I'm more nimble. I'm better at ballet. That piece of cervix had really been weighing me down. I got the results back last week. I have precancerous cells. That sounded scary to me, but it turns out precancerous doesn't turn to cancer for like 10 years, and only if left untreated. So I'm getting it treated. If I had ignored it, those nasty little cells could have killed me down the road. But instead, I faced up to it, sucked up my fears and the inconvenience of going to the doctor, and now something that could have been really bad is now nothing. That's definitely a metaphor for life. So, this is my hot take on adulthood. Get your cervical smear done. Buy 16-year-olds cans of cider if they ask you. And if all else fails, get rich parents so they can help you buy a house.
A public service information message there from comedian Maurice Gohan. And that's very much it for this podcast-only edition of the Culture File Weekly. Don't forget, Saturday evening at 7 is the Culture File Debate, where we discuss the very long history of cultural cancellation, which is also available as a podcast. Daily Culture Files are every Monday to Friday. Till then, bye now.